Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this podcast episode, British scholar Mary Beard has devoted much of her work to sorting myth from fact in the history of Rome. She says that painstaking pursuit creates a kind of conversation with the past that bears rich rewards when we pay close attention. Mary Beard is a professor of classics at Cambridge, an author and TV series host. Her new book is SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. She spoke at Town Hall Seattle on September 19th. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thanks to Sonia Harris for our recording. Please note, the music playing faintly under Mary Beard in the beginning of this recording is not intended to jazz up her talk. It was an oversight at Town Hall and is caught early on in the talk. Here, Town Hall Seattle's Katie Sewell introduces Mary Beard.
Mary Beard is a professor of classics at Cambridge University, where she specializes in ancient history, classical art, and archaeology. She's also the classics editor of the Times Literary Supplement and a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. Her own books include the best-selling book, The Fires of Vesuvius and Pompeii, The Life of a Roman Town, which later served as the basis for a 2010 BBC documentary. And her newest book is titled SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. She's also a popular blogger, a television personality, and she's been involved with a number of programs for the BBC, including Meet the Romans with Mary Beard, Question Time, and Jamie's Dream School. Please join me in welcoming Mary Beard.
Thanks very much for coming, everybody, and it's great to be back in Seattle. But I'm going to talk about Rome, where I first went over 40 years ago now, in 1973. And I still remember that back then one of the things that struck me most vividly were not the ancient remains that I was supposed to be studying or the Renaissance art, but the fact that still stamped on every manhole cover and on every lamppost and public trash can were the letters that 2,000 years earlier had stood as an abbreviation for the ancient Roman state itself. SPQR, Senatus Populusque Romanus, the Senate and Roman people. Even now, and it was given, I have to confess, a little bit of a boost by Mussolini, but even now, it's the symbol and the logo of the modern city of Rome, and I think it's probably the longest lasting acronym in the history of the world. And I'm absolutely certain that if someone had said to me in 1973 that I would wind up almost half a century later having written a history of ancient Rome with exactly that title, I would never have believed them. And I'm here tonight to address, I suppose, the most obvious question that that raises. I suppose, to put it bluntly, why on earth do we need a new history of ancient Rome? Aren't there actually quite enough already? I hope this evening I can show you that and why we do need to keep going back to Rome, and to give you a little taste of what my version of that history is like, and ending up with a new discovery that I've made, which I made too late to get into the book. Now, the first reason that we need a new history of Rome is a very, very simple one. That is, new things about the ancient world are being discovered all the time, and ancient Rome is changing in some very unexpected ways that a historian writing 50 years ago, let alone Gibbon in the 18th century, writing his Decline and Fall, ways that they could never have imagined. And that's often now, not always, but it's often through the appliance of modern science to the ancient world. And one of my favourite examples of this is the material that is coming up right now from the Greenland ice cap, where in deep borings through the ice cap, scientists are bringing up cores of ice which still contain the analysable traces of pollution left by Roman industrial processes at a level that wasn't matched until about 200 years ago. Now, I'm afraid I can't show you a picture of one of these cores themselves, and I expect if you think about it, you'll probably already have guessed that they are a little more complicated than just kind of bringing up this tube of ice and looking for the little black bits. But here is one of the fridges in Utrecht in which they're kept. There's one of my colleagues trying to get one out, actually. If you say, where did that pollution come from? The answer is, we don't fully know, but the best guess is that it's stuff which is getting into the atmosphere from the Roman silver mines in Spain, probably. Spain was the place which basically bankrolled the metal production of the Roman Empire. What I can show you, though, is one of the skulls from Roman Britain, which is the subject of some equally cutting-edge science. In this case, science which is beginning to help us in a way we couldn't ever do before, track the migration and the movement of people in the Roman Empire. Now, we have had tantalising glimpses of that in the past, often glimpses of people's movement from tombstones concerning individuals recorded on their tombstones. And this, from the north of Britain, not far from Hadrian's Wall, is one of the most intriguing little glimpses of that. First sight, there's not anything very special about this tombstone. It's the memorial to a woman, and she's sitting there with a treasure chest at her feet, and she's got her wool work on her lap. It's not the kind of tombstone that would make anybody stop much if they passed her in a museum, but partly because some sad place she had her face all bashed out, you'd probably just kind of leave her on one side. But the text underneath her describes her life story and tells something which is actually rather more unexpected than you might think. It explains that she was a woman called Regina. I suppose we translate that Queenie. And she wasn't born herself near Hadrian's Wall. She came from the south of the country, a couple of hundred miles from where she died. It explains that she'd been a slave, and that she had later been freed from slavery and married a man called Barates, who came from even further away, who came from Palmyra in Syria. And Barates is putting this memorial up to her and commemorating her both in Latin and underneath in his native Aramaic. And I'm going to point out in a minute, just by walking over, how he really, really does boast about where he comes from. The biggest word in this is Palmyrenus. Now, that tombstone and that little life story and that marriage raises all kinds of questions, like what on earth was Barates doing in Britain, thousands of miles away from Palmyra? How on earth had he hitched up with Queenie? Had he once, and this is my guess, My guess is he'd once been her owner and had freed her and then married her. And then, just to be more speculative, I mean, what language do we think they spoke at home? And even more speculative, I think, here we are up in the north of Britain. Did they look odd when they stepped out together in South Shields, which is where they came from, a rather cold northern climate? You know, did people say, "Ooh, that's that odd couple from Syria," you know? Or did they look perfectly normal? Now, it's a fun tombstone, and it raises all those kind of questions, but it's very individual. And it's just one example that we can point to of mobility of people within the Roman Empire. But it's that kind of mobility that we're beginning now to be able to track more widely through particularly the analysis of skeletal remains and in particular the analysis of teeth back to the skull. Because adult teeth, and this is the same for us as it is for the Romans, adult teeth still contain the chemical traces of the environment where the person was living when those teeth were forming in the jaw. Now, the analysis we can do so far is not hugely precise, but you can tell, for example, in relation to this skull here, that the person must have grown up in a significantly warmer climate than the one in which they died. Now, you can't tell which warmer climate. It could be the south of France or it could be North Africa. But on the basis of traces like that, we're beginning to build up a picture of at least those people buried in urban cemeteries in Roman Britain. And we're getting, on the basis of that, a figure of something like 20% of those dying in Roman Britain were born and spent their early childhood in a place a long way away. Quite how long away? That's difficult to know. Now, that is actually an extraordinary degree of mobility for a pre-industrial community, 20%. You know, we're not talking about 10 miles down the road. We're talking about in a different climatic region. And that, in a sense, is giving a wider background to people like Baratis and Queenie and suggesting, in fact, that they wouldn't have looked so strange when they were walking out in South Shields. But I suppose my favourite new discovery is actually what you're looking on the screen now. It is, in fact, a large sewer, or more correctly, I think, a cesspit, in ancient Herculaneum, which is the neighbouring town to Pompeii, also destroyed in 79 AD. And it's a sewer underneath a small, ordinary block of Roman flats. And it is quite literally where everything from the lavatories above ended up entirely unmediated. I mean, the lavatories above this in the block of flats were basically just, you know, holes in the wall, and everything came down into this and then decomposed. It is, in other words, it contained, when discovered, the remains of what went into the mouth and through the digestive tracts of the ordinary people living above. And there was bags and bags and bags and bags of it. And it is currently, or at least a sample of bags, is currently being analysed in Oxford. And it's giving, I have to tell you, if you go and feel it, you know, I thought, when they said, "Oh, come and see it," I thought, "Oh, God, it's going to be really horrible, kind of shitty stuff." In fact, it's like rather upmarket garden compost is what it feels like. And Better Than Garden Compost is giving us enormous amounts of information about what the ordinary people in the flats above were actually eating and consuming. And it's taking us way away from the kind of fantasies of elaborate cookery and exotic delicacies that you find in Roman literature and also in modern movies about Rome. You know, things like, "Oh, Marcus, please pass the dormouse," you know, and it's, "Has it been stuffed with anchovy and honey? I do hope so, because that's my favourite way of doing it," that kind of stuff. If you go to this shit, which is what it is, the answer to what these people are consuming is actually what you'd probably expect. Loads of fruit, figs, pomegranates, eggs, pork, chicken, and fish. And it's quite obvious that sea urchins were a particular favourite, as there are lots of tiny little spikes in the mixture. I think must have been slightly painful, but I don't know. Now, those are all the kinds of, and say, this is my favourite really, those are all the kind of new things or new ways of getting fuller information about particularly the people of the ancient world than we've ever been able to get before. And so I say, I'm coming back at the end of this talk to a rather different but also new discovery. But right now, I should pause and say that in many ways, new discoveries aren't the main reason that you need a new history of Rome, or at least they're only part of it. I think it goes without saying that history isn't simply about uncovering the past, finding out what happened, and moving on. History is about carrying on a conversation with the past. And the different questions that succeeding generations want to raise give different answers and make a different dialogue with the past, and they generate a new history that works and speaks to us. History, in other words, is always a work in progress. It can't be definitive forever. You always have to write it anew. To put it another way, it's not that we are better historians than our predecessors. We have different interests and priorities which make a new sort of history. And Roman history is a very obvious example of those changes. And one thing I think that nobody could miss, and one that's changed dramatically in the course of my lifetime, is how issues of Roman women, sexuality and gender have been treated. To be honest, when I was a student, women didn't really seem to have much of a role in the grand sweep of Roman historical narrative, which was largely about the policies, the aspirations, the deeds and the misdeeds of men, and usually rich men. The only possible exception was in the family of the Roman emperor himself, where sometimes women were assumed to be the power, and usually the villainous power, behind the throne. And none was more villainous than Livia, the wife of the first emperor, Augustus, who, as a jealous mother, is supposed to have got rid of everyone who stood in the way of her own son, Tiberius, rising to the throne to succeed Augustus. In the end, it was said that she even killed her husband, the emperor, by, according to some Roman writers, an extremely clever strategy. Augustus was a wily old thing, and he was always on the lookout for poisoners, and he had all the food that he ate at table carefully tasted by servants before he would touch it. So what Livia is said to have done, and one doesn't believe this for a minute, but what she's said to have done is painted poison on the figs as they grew on the tree in the palace garden, because no one ever bothers to have tasted for poison fruit they pick directly from the tree, and Augustus was rather partial to figs from the tree. And it eventually, or rather quite soon, killed him. It made a marvellous moment in that old TV series, I, Claudius, where Sean Phillips, as you see here, starred horribly as a very wicked Livia. And I remember at this point, after she's finally said goodbye to, in a very loving farewell to the dying husband that she's actually been poisoning, Tiberius comes in to make sure that there's a seamless transition of power, and Livia goes out. But as she goes out, she says to Tiberius, "Oh, by the way, don't touch the figs." Now, it's partly the result of modern feminism, I think, that most historians now, although there are some exceptions, don't take those stories about Livia and the others quite so straight and quite so uncritically, even when they do go back to Roman writers themselves. I think we're now much more aware of the way that in highly patriarchal societies such as Rome, and one could probably add the modern West to that, but Rome, male fantasies often project crime and wicked scheming onto women who happen to be close to the centre of power. Women and transgressive female ambition are often used as explanatory devices for the accidents of history. So I don't think it's entirely gone away. There was really a touch of the Livia about the way that the British press used to treat Sherry Blair. You know, when they wanted to explain something that Blair had done, they'd say, Cherie's idea that was, particularly when they didn't like it. So when I'm writing now, I'm obviously telling a very different story because I've got that sense of patriarchal bias very much in mind. And if you read my SPQR, you'll find rather few female poisoners at work, certainly a lot fewer than you'd find in earlier books. And I suppose I should add at this point that part of the point of my title, SPQR, Senatus Populusque Romanus, the Senate and Roman People, is an attempt, though I'm not going to go into this now, to rescue not only women from oblivion, but also the Roman people, i.e. the ordinary men and women of the street, by parading the people alongside the Senate. I'm trying to remind us all that Roman history isn't just about the toffs. But the big example with which I start the book is one with a particular modern resonance for us, and particularly interestingly inflected in our own modern political debate. It's a famous moment in 63 BC, and centre stage in this moment is Marcus Tullius Cicero, one of the best known Romans of them all, volumes and volumes of whose letters, speeches, philosophical essays, and even jokes we still possess. Now, in 63 BC, Cicero was consul, the annual chief elected official in Rome, and he believed that he had uncovered a terrorist plot to overthrow the government and burn the city down, led by a disgruntled aristocrat called Lucius Sergius Catilina, or usually just Catiline to us. Now, on screen is a 19th century painting which shows Cicero on the left in full flow addressing the Senate, denouncing a rather moody Catiline over the other side, who's all alone because no one wants to sit by him, right? Appropriately enough, this 19th century painting was originally commissioned, and it's still there, to be in one of the common rooms in the Italian Parliament building. So you have to imagine that Berlusconi used to have his cappuccino in front of this painting. It's a pity he didn't take the message, I think. Now, Cicero clearly here, as you can see, is in the middle of orating. He's denouncing Catiline, and the speech that we have to imagine Cicero utters actually still survives as it's been copied and studied and practiced ever since. And it's still on school Latin syllabuses all over the Western world. It's known as the first Catilinarian speech, Cicero's first speech against Catiline, and he's telling Catiline to get out of town. And it starts with one of the most famous Latin quotes ever. Quousque tandem abutere Catilina patientia nostra. How long, Catiline, will you go on abusing our patience? That was a quote that schoolboys were learning from about 62 BC, I think. Now, the upshot of the speech was that Catiline fled the city. Whether he was actually guilty as charged, we shall never know, but I don't think he was entirely innocent because he joined outside the city a makeshift army and he was later killed in battle against the official forces. Meanwhile, in Rome itself, Cicero rounded up the rest of those people that he believed to be involved in Catiline's plot and executed them without trial, claiming the justification and the protection for that of an early form of a Homeland Security Act. He came out, having overseen the executions, he came out to meet the public and uttered to them just one chilling word, which also became very famous. He said, "Vix aere," which means they have lived, i.e. they're not living any longer, they're dead, right? Vix aere, they're dead. Now, to start with, after this, Cicero was heroised as saviour of the state. But soon, doubts began to grow about the precise legality of his actions, as one of the fundamental principles of Roman citizenship was that the citizen, unlike the non-citizen, was entitled to a fair and free trial and could not be arbitrarily punished by any state official, no matter what crime they were suspected of, without a fair trial. Cicero soon found himself in exile on the charge of having executed those citizens without due process. And as he left town, his house was demolished and a shrine of the goddess Liberty was erected on its site. In fact, he was allowed to come back within a few months, but his career never quite recovered. Now, that dilemma of Cicero versus Catiline was debated ever after in Rome. And it doesn't take much to see the echoes or the prequel here of our own debates on almost exactly the same unanswerable question, and I think it is unanswerable, which is, how do you balance the security of the state against the rights of the individual citizen? And the problem of Cicero versus Catiline, I think, is always, in my mind at least, when we now debate, as we do, issues about detention without trial, about Guantanamo Bay, or more recently, the killing by British forces of British citizens fighting for ISIS. And if you want a nice glimpse of quite the topicality still of Cicero's words, just take a look at these Hungarian protesters a couple of years ago. they have got their banner out, and it's actually Cicero's slogan that they're waving in their protest. Quos quae tandem. Right. Now, I think these guys are quite old, but it's still nice to see Cicero's very Latin, still part of, very visibly part of our own political debate, but always slightly meaning something slightly new to match present political circumstances. Now, of course, the whole notion and question of the rights of Roman citizenship and what a Roman citizen should be entitled to are not entirely a recent problem for us. But they're just always, I think, being reinflected. So if you go back, famous American moment, you go back 50 years to the middle of the Cold War, and John F. Kennedy was exploiting the ideals of Roman citizenship, but for slightly different reasons, when he gave his Ich bin ein Berliner speech, which is what this is a photograph of. 2,000 years ago, he insisted, the proudest boast was civis Romanus sum, I am a Roman citizen. Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is Ich bin ein Berliner. Now, it's rightly one of the most famous speeches of the 20th century, but there is, I have to tell you, a little sting in the tail. What Kennedy didn't realise, or perhaps probably better, what his speechwriters didn't realise, was that the most famous and the most quotable use of that phrase, civis Romanus sum, in ancient Rome, was actually a decidedly awkward one. They were the words repeatedly cried out from the cross by an unfortunate and entirely innocent citizen on the island of Sicily who was being crucified by a rogue Roman governor. Even if guilty, Roman citizens were by law immune from the degrading punishment of crucifixion. So the man was desperately trying to claim his citizen rights in calling out, civis Romanus sum, civis Romanus sum, but it made not a blind bit of difference, and he died in agony. Now, I don't think that when Kennedy's speechwriters were looking for an ancient parallel to Ich bin ein Berliner, they realised what a nasty parallel they had found in this phrase, civis Romanus sum, the sad cry of a man trying to get his citizen rights, but completely and ignominiously and painfully failing. But I want to spend the last part of this talk going back to the new kind of discoveries that I was talking about, and I want to share a rediscovery of my own, as I said, one that I made some time after SPQR had gone to press, and I think that it's another, though rather different, case of the sort of new things that turn up about Rome all the time and in the most unexpected of places. Just to set the context, one of the questions that I puzzle about in SPQR is a tricky question of when Rome became the Rome that we know. That's to say, the place starts off probably in the 9th or the 8th centuries BC as a very small, very ordinary little place. It's a bit of a dump, actually, by the Tiber. When does it become the Rome that we know, with the institutions, the ways of doing things, and the expansionist tendencies that we now think of as Roman? When, if you like, does it become SPQR? Now, I'm not going to give away all the answers to that, but it won't spoil the read of the book, I think, if I say that I'm pretty clear that the really key formative, or perhaps you might say transformative, period is not until the 4th century BC. That's 4 centuries into the city's history. To put another way, Rome spent 400 years being a dump before it became the Rome that we know. And at the same time, alongside that, I'm pretty clear that the first Romans that we encounter, who are more historical than mythical, because you know, Romulus is an exciting character, but he certainly never existed, right? The first Romans that we encounter who are historical characters, and certainly the ones that we have direct primary evidence for, because Latin literature is rather slow off the ground, they lived around the turn of the 4th and 3rd century BC. So the history of Rome, in the modern sense of history, you could almost say starts in the 4th to 3rd centuries BC. And the first man of all, who turns out to be quite a hero in my first chapter, the first man of all we can get any direct contemporary account of, is a guy from one of the most prominent families in Rome, a man called Scipio Barbatus, which means Scipio Longbeard, or Scipio Beardy. And that's why I like him, I think. He was consul, main magistrate in the city, in 298 BC, when Rome was beginning to get, in fact had got, quite a lot of control over the Italian peninsula, and hadn't quite yet started to expand overseas. Now, Scipio Barbatus' descendants, men like Scipio Africanus and Scipio Aemilianus, went on to be some of the most successful, or bloodstained, if you prefer it that way, Roman conquerors of all. It was Africanus and Aemilianus who finally kind of did for Hannibal. But Barbatus is 100 and so years before them, 100 and 200 years, and the ancestor of the family. Now, almost all the traces, I'm going to show you some in a minute, that we can find of Scipio Barbatus look very archaic. And they would have looked very archaic and old-fashioned to later Romans too. But at the time, he was a hugely innovative representative of the new Rome, the Rome that we have now come familiar with. Among other things, he was the first to build himself a big family tomb on the first big road that was ever built out of the city, the Appian Way. And this is Piranesi's fantastically imaginative version of that tomb from the late 18th century. You can, in fact, still visit it. That's what it looks like now from the inside. And that sits slightly down at heel exterior with a friend of mine texting in front of it. And this, you see what I mean about archaic, this is the tomb of Barbatus himself, the sarcophagus of Barbatus himself. And inscribed on its facade is what is effectively the first mini biography of any Roman to have survived. And it's extraordinarily revealing of the ideology of this period. We don't know exactly when Barbatus died, but a good guess would be about the 280s. So it's still 250 years before the assassination of Julius Caesar. And you've got here on the screen the words which I think speak for themselves. Gives Cornelius Lucius Scipio Barbatus, it gives his name, it gives his father's name. It says that he was brave and wise. This is quite odd. We don't think about the Romans in these terms, really. His appearance was equal to his virtue. He looked good. He cut a dash. Then it gives his offices. He was consul, censor, and aedile, three offices amongst you. And then here's something where we suddenly see Rome in all its glory. He captured Tarasia, he captured Kizana and Samnium, he subdued all Lucania and took hostages. Right? So you have there, in a sense, the first surviving biography of any Roman with already all those kind of distinctively Roman ideological chords very clearly on the table. And I think it means, you can see what I mean, I think, when you say that by this point, Romans have become Roman, right? And there's nothing like this before. But there's another story here too that I've been tracking down over the last few months, and one that leads back right straight to Barbatus himself. And that's the story of the tombs uncovering in the late 18th century, that in 1780 to be precise. The excavation was something of a cause célèbre because it was sponsored by Pope Pius VI, who took all the stuff worth having back to the Vatican, raising a lot of questions about how come the church was disturbing the last resting place of the dead. So when you visit now, that sarcophagus of Barbatus that you see is actually a replica in the tomb, and the original sarcophagus is still in the Vatican Museum. Now, it's partly those arguments surrounding the rights and wrongs of the Pope's excavation here that gave the tomb huge, really huge fame in the 19th century and made it what it certainly isn't now, which is a tourist hotspot in the city. In fact, so much a kind of tourist hotspot is that you find replicas of Barbatus's coffin cropping up in all kinds of unlikely places. Here's one in Highgate Cemetery, North London. Here's one in Laurel Hill, Philadelphia. It's the last resting place of Commodore Isaac Hull. And if you go to the Protestant cemetery in Rome, you find no fewer than 9 of them, not quite all lined up in a row, but almost. And just suppose you didn't actually fancy being buried in one, you could always turn Scipio's tomb into what every 19th century desk needed, which is a Scipio Barbatus inkwell. What you do is you take the little top off, and there you've got the little pots underneath where you keep the ink and the nibs. I bought that in an auction in Cambridge about a year ago. But it doesn't take long to see that there's another question lurking here. If the Pope took the coffin of Barbatus off to the Vatican, what actually happened to Barbatus's mortal remains? People were worried about disturbing the dead, but where had the dead gone? Now, we can answer that a bit. It seems that the bones themselves ended up in an elaborate villa garden in Padua after they'd been given by the Pope to a well-known Venetian Senator Querini, who incorporated them into his rather posh philosophical garden at Altichiero. Now, that garden has been destroyed. This is a drawing of the memorial which, up till the late 19th century, was said to have contained the bones of Scipio Barbatus, transferred from his tomb. Quite what those phallic things are on either side of it, I'm not quite sure. But anyway, they've all gone, and I've got no idea. I suspect I could get further if I tried a bit harder. I haven't got any closer to finding what happened to Barbatus's bones next. But there was something else. On his finger, Barbatus had been wearing a signet ring. Now, this didn't go to Padua, with the bones, but the Pope gave it to a French scholar, Monsieur Louis Dutton, who had written about the Scipio family. Dutton was actually a bit of a social climber and was very well in with the British aristocracy, and he later sold it, or gave it, to the English Lord Berkeley. And in the late 19th century, by a combination of sale and inheritance, Barbatus's ring was said to have ended up in the collections of the Dukes of Northumberland at Alnwick Castle. That's Alnwick Castle. If it looks familiar, it's because bits of Harry Potter and bits of Downton Abbey were filmed there. After it's got to Alnwick, the trail goes cold and it's not mentioned again. I decided it was worth an email. So I sent an email to the Duke's administration at Alnwick, though I didn't really imagine that it would still be there. But after a certain kind of ducal delay, I got an email back to say that the ring was indeed still in their possession, and here it is. That is the ring that Barbatus was wearing in his tomb. It's plain gold. And appropriately enough, for the military ambitions of the Scipio family and someone who conquered all Lucania and took hostages, it has the figure of victory as its emblem. But for me, I have to say, there is a bit more of a special thrill. I think this counts as the only bit of Roman jewellery that we can match up with a known historical Roman owner. It's the only ring with a famous Roman name attached to it. And where does it turn up? In a British medieval castle. Now, that was a few months ago, and you'll be saying, so haven't I actually driven up to see it? It's only about 3 hours' drive away. And I'm embarrassed, I think, to say that I haven't. I hope not because I'm too lazy. I think it's more because I'm a bit too excited about it in a way. And I've kind of gone through this in my head and I think how cross I'm going to be if they won't let me try it on. You know, one thing I want to do is to put Scipio Barbatus's ring on my finger, and I don't really want to know they're not going to let me. But one thing is for sure, that if my SPQR is lucky enough to get a full second edition, this ring is going to play a big part in the story. And meanwhile, you have had a sneak preview of it. So thank you very much.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum featuring Professor Mary Beard. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thanks again to Sonia Harris for our recording. Tune in again soon.